Hi everyone, you're listening to Venturi's Voice. I'm your host, Andy Davis. This show is all about building a hub of relevant, insightful, and actionable business insights that can help drive greater performance and innovation. I've worked with several tech startups myself and know from experience that success is underpinned by a passion for continual learning and growth. So I'm grateful to have the opportunity to speak with our guests and learn from their stories. If you enjoy this podcast, you can download the free ebook featuring my personal podcast highlights from the past 2 years at www.venturi-group.com/podcast-ebook. If you're looking for more information on today's episode, just head over to the Venturi website to check out the show notes. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. Today's guest is Tor Gisvold, the CTO at Adaga. Tor, thank you so much for taking the time. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Andy. Looking forward to it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Likewise. I think it's needless to say that you've had quite the career to date. I don't want to try and give away how long you've been actually in the industry, but it's certainly quite a while. So I think we've got some really compelling periods of time to cover. Because one of the things that comes to mind and what gets me extremely excited about kind of talking to someone like you with such amazing experience is just to get to grips with how much things have actually changed over the periods of time. And I don't know whether since you're in it and, you know, we all get incredibly busy on our day-to-day lives and things tend to kind of blur into one, about how conscious you are about how significant things within technology have changed, or whether it's something that you only realize down the road when you actually are able to draw a bit of perspective on things.
I think I've been reasonably aware of it, maybe more than at any other time the last couple of years, because the pace of technology change seems to have accelerated quite a bit. I started out at the very early stage of microcomputers. I'd probably give everything away by saying that the first microcomputer I had was an ABC-80, which no one has heard about because it was very Scandinavian. It was a, if I remember correctly, a 2 or 4K 8080 or a Z80 in it. And then I changed over to Apple's not too long after that. So it was sort of in the beginning of this microcomputer revolution, which has changed so much. But I would say the last couple of years working in AI makes me really feel how much things have changed, and possibly also how much things are going to change in the near future, because it's just an accelerating pace, and it's hard sitting in something like a CTO position and trying to keep abreast of all the technologies out there at the moment.
Well, you obviously worked in, you know, like several large consultancy firms. So there's probably like working in those kind of positions, I suppose, that you are able to draw a bit more perspective because, you know, you're working with so many different businesses and different clients. But I can imagine that almost being worse because it's a bit overwhelming about how much there is to take in and consider.
Yeah, so the advantage of working in the big companies is that there are generally a lot of people around with expertise in different fields. So if it's one field you can't understand or you don't know enough about, there's always someone else to talk about. And that's a big difference between the small companies and the big companies. On the other hand, the speed of change tends to be a lot bigger in small companies because you have focus on something specific and you don't have so many layers of red tape or approvals or hindrance or bureaucracy to go to as you have in the large companies.
Yeah.
So in that respect, I've been incredibly lucky because I've worked for some of the really large companies on this planet, and I've also worked for some of the small ones. I worked for some that has failed, including one of my own. And I've worked for some that has been incredibly successful. Although, and I have to say, I'm a typical nerd, so I've never made any significant money out of the very successful companies, which is the to say that I'm probably more interested in what I'm doing and the content of it and the technology than I am in making a lot of money out of it, for better or worse.
Yeah, interesting. You know, the interesting thing about, I suppose, working in, as you alluded to, large versus small, I think some people perceive that, you know, in the sport, it's almost like a bit more roll up the sleeves and get things done. Throughout the different, I would say, like, periods of your career, where perhaps you were kind of directly getting things done, I suppose, versus the strategic element of it. You know, is there an area which you've kind of enjoyed more so than others with that regard? Have you enjoyed kind of plotting out things from a high level, from a strategic perspective, or did you ever long for the days where you were able to roll up the sleeves and write some code?
It's a very, very good question, because it's a bit of both. I would say that if I think back into consultancy not too many years ago at PwC, there was a lot of very strategic work being done. But then it could suddenly very, very quickly change into having to roll up your sleeves and do something again. I guess a good example of that is sitting in the office one day working on long-term architecture for a big project. I had a phone call, which meant that the same night I was on my way out to the World Health Organization in Geneva, working on the fight against Ebola. And there it was really rolling up your sleeve and actually writing code and figuring out how to save people's lives, actually, in that. So the one thing about the big companies is that you don't get to focus too long on something in general. You have to move between projects if you are sitting in a reasonably senior position in the company. In a small company, you generally don't have that. You have a product you're developing, or at least a smaller range of product, and you get time to, for better or worse, to focus on those. And generally, if you're there in the startup phase, you have limited funds as well and limited means. So you have to be careful about what you do and how you make decisions. There are advantages to both, and I've been incredibly lucky in having enjoyed both types of work. But there's been a couple of phases that have been quite different. So not too many years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, I went from a reasonably big company, IBM, 8,000 staff across Europe, and left and went to work for a company out in California. At that stage, when I joined, we were around 400 people. When I left a year later, we were a bit past 1,000.
Yeah.
And we were wildly, wildly successful in what we did. But we were also extremely hands-on. I guess for people that understand the industry, I can say that we had around 20,000 servers sitting there and across the globe. We were very, very hands-on. We racked and cabled everything ourselves. But the whole core technology team, outside of development, was very, very small. The operational part of that and the day-to-day part was 29 people. That's covering 20 data centers. And we did some amazing things there, which was really good fun, but also very hard work. Really did really enjoy that time out in California.
Interesting. Whereabouts in California was that, just out of interest?
It was in Santa Monica.
Ah, lovely. I actually lived in Santa Monica for a couple of years.
Okay. I lived on 22nd Street and Union, or something like that. So I lived most of the time in a small family-run hotel there, because I was commuting back and forth. And then I lived down in a very new hotel called The Shore, that all the way down by the pier for a while as well.
Yeah, I know that one. Yeah, it's beautiful around there. I lived relatively close, actually, just on 7th and California. So yeah, pretty close.
Very, very close. So you spent a lot of time down on 2nd or something like that, walking up and down.
Yeah, definitely did. Yeah, down. When I was at a startup, and we actually had offices just above some of the shops on the 3rd Street Promenade there. So yeah, it was.
So we took over most of the old Yahoo Center, if you ever been up there.
Yeah.
So that's where we lived at. That's where we worked at that stage.
Yeah, it's amazing. A lot of commerce going out that way. Even a lot of the players in Silicon Valley kind of looking out that, looking south really. I think there's just a bit more activity, a bit more to do in that area, to be quite honest.
It is, and it's nice during the weekend to walk out and so on. But I find that, to me, it was working in a small company that had big ambitions, really understood what they were doing, were surprisingly diverse, and had money to throw at projects. So spending millions were not on technology were not a problem. It's fairly unusual, and it's probably never happened before or later in my career.
Interesting.
That you could buy as much kit very, very quickly, just off a credit card. That's interesting. So I worked on, among many things, on open compute or open source computing, i.e. open source hardware, which is still fairly unusual. As a matter of fact, there's probably less and less of it because we are all moving most of our kit or our infrastructure to the cloud these days. So that was probably one of them. But still one of the more exciting things I was doing at that stage. All kicked off by the Facebook engineering team, by the way, which I had the privilege of spending a little bit of time with as well.
What an experience. That sounds like incredible. And, you know, with the, obviously to the point we talked about big and small, but what about the kind of the cross industry as well? I know that you were kind of part in the gaming industry for a while and various others. Obviously, we mentioned consultancy as well. You know, technology seems to be sort of, you know, one of the areas where it seemingly can cross boundaries more easily so than kind of other professions that perhaps may be forced by the nature of them to be a bit more siloed. But from your experience, was there kind of significant differences even within technology working in different industries?
To be honest, there isn't. There is an advantage to knowing the industry you work in. And some of the industries have very specific ways of working, very specific codes of working. But the technology is in many respects a great leveler for all of that. Because when I worked in broadcasting or when I worked in newspapers and when I worked in the gaming industry or worked in crisis management or I was down at Burberry, for example, in sorting out some of the accounting systems and so on, it didn't matter too much. The problems you came across were roughly the same. The amount of red tape and testing you had to do was the big difference between them. So I found that, as a good example, going into gaming at the age of 50-odd worked out quite well. Because I think that there's an interesting thing if you look at the industry now. I find that a problem with a lot of these startup companies comes when they're starting to deliver to larger clients. Because to do that, you have to have some experience in how to do things. And there's no good textbooks around how to deliver, how to act when things go south, and how to deliver on a large scale into corporates. Most small technology companies and startup companies are very, very inexperienced in that by the very nature of what they're doing, because they are generally staffed by a lot of young enthusiasts, which is why I'm intrigued by a major change in technology for people with gray hair at the moment, which is going in the direction of fractional CTOs or the fact that you can rent in an experienced CTO for a short period of time or for one day a week or 2 days a week to help you with those slightly different problems from what you started the company to do. So I think that there's suddenly a lot of different opportunities out there compared to what it was a couple of years ago. These fractional technology companies are really, really intriguing for people that are getting as old as I am. And at some stage, they realize they probably want to work less than 5 days a week. By the way, that time hasn't come for me yet, but yeah. I can see that in my future.
But it's an interesting one, actually. It's something that you don't really consider, because I think the, you know, the nature of technology and just the, you know, the just the logistics behind how long it's been, I suppose, for lack of like a desirable career, let's say, it's not really been that long. It's almost like only just like one generation old, really. So, you know, that...
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. So I wrote some of the first, or part of writing, some of the first local area network systems and hard disk subsystems for Apple. It's not that many years ago. I remember before Apple, before hard disks existed for Apple or really existed for microcomputers at all. And it's not that long ago. Yeah. I probably have lots of floppies laying around in boxes somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, that had all
very big hard disks.
Yeah, well, they probably have a lot to answer for. Yeah, I'm sure. But yeah, but to that point though, you know, I think that's part of the problem as well, and something that really, I suppose, is scary to a certain extent as well, is that it's a certain generation and a certain group and age of people that are, for the most part, relatively speaking, super inexperienced compared to the seniority levels that other industries will have. And they're making decisions that are like unprecedented in a lot of cases as well. You know, there continue to be a precedent that's set in technology year after year after year. And you've got people who perhaps aren't as experienced on the decision-making end as they would be if they were in another industry. There's clearly a gap there and a market for people with your like experience level to come in and really help with making things like the decision-making process. And I think for an industry in general, it's clearly there's a lot of, there's a deficit there. There's a lot of extremely interesting people. But to that point, there's something that perhaps can't be taught for through anything other than just experience in working at a super senior level and executing on, you know, high level decisions that I think you can only probably attain from experience. And ironically, I can't claim to have that experience, but there we go. That's my assumption.
I think you're right. And I've spent a lot of time discussing that lately with various people. And I've got quite a number of friends now or former colleagues that have gone into these fractional roles where they actually spend, let's say, a day a week with a specific company. The next day they go to another company. The third day they are with a third company. And basically use the sounding boards. You can call it mentors for some of them, but it is when you get to certain kinds of problems or certain kinds of sales or certain kinds of technology that you need someone that understands that you have to have some experience in how to deliver that and how to maintain it in specifically. And I think there's very little of that because some of the technologies we're trying to roll out now hasn't really been battle tested that much, and people, even the people working on them, don't quite understand them. Artificial intelligence, for some of the deep learning models, being a typical area where no one quite knows how they work. And that's a bit scary, and it needs a bit of extra thought around how to deliver those and how to apply them. Because we could be on the brink of making some really, really bad decisions in all of that.
Do you think that is it then? It is the ability to make decisions that is cross-functional, that experience level that, you know, you see for the most part a lot of perhaps these big technology companies that are constantly under the microscope for various different things, that is almost a key area that is a deficit then, would you say, if you were to kind of paint a broader picture?
So I'm no real expert on this, but I would say so. If just think of it being in the position of Mark Zuckerberg at the moment. There's very clearly lots of things. He's a very, very bright guy that's built an enormous company. There's also clearly a lot of areas he hasn't thought about because he either hasn't had experience or the advice or the time.
Right.
And you can see that with several of these companies. Have a look at Cambridge Analytica and the scandals around that, for example. It is people that have been mesmerized by the technology and what they can do, as opposed to thinking through what they've done and how to do it. I think so. We to a certain degree, at the moment, there's a lot of thought or thinking around artificial intelligence, its application, and whether it's ethical or not, which is an interesting way of looking at technology, which we really haven't done much of earlier.
Yeah.
So all of that is clearly fairly new, seen from my point of view, and intriguing. But it's not something you do. It's hard to do if you haven't got any experience in the field or any experience, period. It's all seen from my point of view, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think that's the interesting thing about artificial intelligence for me, is the fact that like it is still humans dictating how it operates and how it works. So that's clearly like dangerous to a certain extent within itself.
It is very dangerous in itself, but if no one, including the people that write the code or apply the code, quite understand how it works, they just see it comes up with interesting results, then you have a bit of a problem. If you can't explain how it works to anyone, then we are in a slightly gray area, slightly dark area, because that may lead us into doing things with where we can't pull back from it.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, in many respects, we've probably seen that most with self-driving cars, and all the decisions a car has to make when it's in a specific situation. Starting thinking through those and drawing out the problems from that is not an easy thing to do.
Mm.
So technology and the speed we're introducing some of the technology, it is giving us a lot of interesting problems. I deliberately say interesting because even though they may be difficult, there's some really, really interesting stuff going in there, which technologists haven't been involved enough in before.
Well, I think that's it. And that's why, but I think that's also the risk factor with it, the fact that things are so interesting and compelling. We're like a group of moths, aren't we? We're just attracted to these shiny things. And ultimately, you're more motivated to make them happen. But is it for the right reasons? Is it just because it's bright and shiny? Or have we considered that, you know, actually might burn us?
Yeah, and I have some thoughts around some of this. A good example is that we keep on saying that the digital generation or the up-and-coming generation now can't focus on anything. Oh, they can hop very, very quickly. They get fascinated by something and it jumps on to the next thing. So you have so little time to catch their imagination and their attention span. The intriguing thing here is if you start looking at the gaming industry then again. So League of Legends, which I worked on, the average login time was 3 hours or 3.5 hours, actually. And during that time, you had to focus. You really had to focus because you were playing in a team. And you would let the team down if you went to the toilet or if you went out for a cup of coffee or your concentration wavered.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly we had hundreds of millions of young people that managed to focus for 3.5 hours, which is totally contrary to what people tell you if you talk to the advertising industry and so on. So maybe there's much more we could learn from each other in all of this. In some respects, I would really have liked to be smart enough to distill some of the knowledge we got out of the gaming industry and apply it to other industries that want to get people to focus on things for a longer period of time. We did a number of things out in California that was not common. So we were there. As a matter of fact, the guy that runs esports worldwide was on the same induction course as me out in Santa Monica. And who would believe that esports could be so big as it is now? So you get millions of people tuning in to watch someone playing a game, an online game.
Yeah.
And you get tens of thousands of people turning up in a stadium to watch it. Absolutely not something you could have believed a few years ago.
Yeah. Oh, well, I believe it now. It's enormous, isn't it, esports? It's crazy. Yeah. I think... You know, it's particularly fascinating, the scale, and I think that's what it's given us and what's allowed us. And I think as humans, we're limited by our perception of scale, aren't we? And I think
we are, and that's why I'm so fascinated and admire so much the guy that started Riot Games at that stage, because the things they did, one of them was starting a freemium game. Who could believe that a free game could make as much money out of micropayments? So they're really the first large-scale use of global micropayments in-game. And the second one, starting esports and plowing lots of money into that before they could see any payback. It's absolutely fascinating that someone can think that large scale and startup companies doing these things. That's something I can't do.
Yeah,
I'm a nerd. I'm not the guy that has the long-term vision on the business side.
Yeah. Well, that's the value in that kind of thing. And I think it's pretty comprehensive that there are people out there that are consciously doing this, but then there's also people who are consciously not doing it as well. And are kind of just stumbling across these things. And, you know, I think that's where perhaps the scary side of things comes in, is where things are happening so quickly that we can't even control the scale of, you know, the distribution of the messaging, you know. And that's, I think that, you know,
yeah,
that's where, I don't know, maybe that's where decentralization begins to play a role with blockchain, etc.
Yeah, and the interesting, blockchain's now been around for a number of years. Really interesting technology, which hasn't quite found its niche yet.
No.
Lots of people working on it, lots of people I know very well, betting their future on it. But it hasn't really found its perfect niche at the moment. I can see lots of good applications for it, but they haven't really come to pass yet, that's, as far as I can see.
Yeah. Well, it's like anything, isn't it? You know, there's every technology needs a purpose. There's a lot of really fascinating things out there, but if you can't monetize, or, you know, it can't really find its place, there's never going to be a need for it, is there, I suppose? And there's almost more of that now than ever before.
So I agree, because it's become so much, the barrier to starting up a company has become lower and lower. You don't need that much investment or that much money to start a company today.
Mm-hmm.
To become successful, you still need some money, but it's easier to start up something and get a little bit of investment, which isn't terribly hard today, but it was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. So that's definitely changing. We're becoming more like California in that respect, aren't we?
Well, there's no question about that. Isn't everyone, apparently, these days? So.
Yes, I think we are. I think even my original country, Norway, is getting more American than it ever was.
Yeah.
For better or worse.
There's pros and cons to that, I suppose, pros and cons, which we probably won't go into, but that's certainly a factor.
Then it would become a political podcast instead of a technical podcast.
Yeah, and unfortunately at the moment, the way the climate is, I think that seems to be getting closer and closer to becoming hand-in-hand, inevitably.
I think they are, and I think we're becoming sort of full circle in some of that, where for a number of years, technology or people working in technology hasn't been terribly politically motivated. Whereas when I was going to uni, we did anti-Vietnam demos and all of that kind of stuff, which was very politically motivated and active. Now it's starting up again in another wave, and some of it around climate and even worse around the thing we're not going to talk about, which is Brexit.
Yeah, no, God, that's an illegal word from now on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well,
being Norwegian, I'm allowed to joke about it.
Yeah, of course. Well, you have to. If you don't, you'll cry, probably. So feel free to do so.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you as well, speaking of climate, actually, I was told that you developed, this is actually really relevant for me, that you developed an app that detects different pollen counts and different kinds of pollen for allergy sufferers. This would be incredibly useful for me, by the way. So please do tell me more.
Okay, so the background for all of this is in our family, both my wife, my son, and at least one of the cats have allergy problems, which leads to a number of things. And at the moment, I'm laying floors. So we're ripping up everywhere we move. We rip up all carpets and put in wooden floors. We live in a situation where we have lots of sensors in the house, both because I'm interested in the technology and trying to find a practical application for it. So I'm just now standing here watching a particle sensor. So that's a laser-based sensor that counts the amount of particles in various sizes in the air, both inside and outside the house, because I'm trying to reduce that as much as possible, because they are, all of them are terribly allergic to certain types of pollen.
Mm-hmm.
So the my thinking behind that is, when I walk into town occasionally, I can see these big cars standing there. They sent out to measure pollution and air quality, and they stand at a street corner for a while, and then they move on again. I think the future is in everyone having counters like that around their house and inside their house and so on, so we have more knowledge about what's going on. And to me, this is where technology comes into it. These kind of sensors are inexpensive at the moment. What we need is an infrastructure where we can collect all of this information and, by the way, calibrate all of these sensors. But if you start connecting hyperlocal data about particle counts, you can't know what type of pollen the sensor detects. You can know the size of the particles, and therefore also the most. There's one set of sizes that describes pollen very well. But if you know what grows in the area, you have a good chance of working out what kind of pollen you have in there, and therefore also what people could be allergic to. So if you combine location technology, big data, and a bit of artificial intelligence, and old data from earlier years about what happens when and when things flower and so on, you can start giving people with severe allergies a much better life by telling them where not to go or where to go during a day. And we see a big difference, and we've experimented a lot with, over the last couple of years, with filters in the house. So we have HEPA filters and ozone filters and carbon filters and all of that. And I can actually now, in this room I'm standing in now, I can see from the measurements of the particle sensors whether the cat's in the room or not.
Right.
Because the moment the cat walks in, I can see the pollen count going up.
Interesting.
As a curiosity, when I see it's a specific time, I see a real spike in particles in there, and that's whenever we fry bacon. It seems to generate more particles in the air than anything else we can do.
Bacon, did you say?
Enough. Yeah. Very, very well. But from this, I can know whether we should keep the windows closed or not, only to give the filters the chance to clean the air. And I can see roughly whether there's a lot of pollen or whether there's a lot of dust in the house. And we can take action to reduce the amount of that quite easily. And that makes a big difference. My son got a new girlfriend some time ago, and she kept on coughing during the night until we put a filter in the room. I don't think she knew we even put the filter in. And it stopped. It's the same for him as well. And we personally, or rather my wife, sees the difference that we got the filters going, but we got the windows opening and where we are. And I can see the same on the curves of data from the particle sensors. So I think here there's something really interesting going on. And what I'm very keen on is having an infrastructure around this publicly available infrastructure so you can start seeing other people's senses as well.
Awesome. I think it sounds fascinating. Especially for me, who is an allergy sufferer as well, this would be really compelling.
It should be. I've got the carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide sensors in the house as well. And if, as I occasionally do, run on the treadmill, I can actually see the CO2 level in the room going up. As a matter of fact, it's 674 ppm just now, which is actually quite high. Normally, it's 400.
Right.
So for some reason, I'm generating a lot of CO2 at the moment.
Yeah.
But it's more at the, from an engineering point of view, you want to know what's going on. You want to put a figure to anything and everything. And this is what fascinates me with a lot of the microcomputers and a lot of the very easily available technology to do things like this, which we couldn't a few years ago.
Amazing. It's been absolutely fascinating to talk with you, Tor. Thank you so much for taking the time, mate. It's been a very, very, very well spent sort of half an hour, for me at least. For you, perhaps not as much, but certainly for me.
No, I love doing this, and I think as long as we can talk about interesting things, why not? And I think as technologists, we're generally not too good about communicating what we're doing. Either because we only talk to other people that are doing exactly the same, or we're definitely not good enough about spreading and doing the good stuff.
Yeah.
Which is why I mentioned that the project we worked on for the World Health Organization on. We can do good things with technology, and we should do more good things with technology than we're doing at the web.
Agreed. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yep.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to check out more of Venturi's voice, but you're unsure where to begin, you can find my recommended top 12 episodes at venturi-group.com/podcast-ebook. See you next time.